Jones Network. Tomorrow's news today.
If you are receiving this transmission, you are the resistance.
This is Matt Bracken, and this is my first time doing the Sunday evening show when we wrap up the week, look at the next week, and pretty much let it all hang out. I'm filling in for Alex. I know you all wish he was here, so do I, but it is what it is, and we do the best we can with the tools at our hands. And there's so much going on. I mean, we could go in so many directions right now. I'm going to start in Ireland, which I think is the epicenter or the focal point as like the ultimate beta test for population replacement. You know, if we can do this, the globalists, if they can do this to a small, cohesive, homogenous country like Ireland, then where can't they do it? And in the terms of being a beta test, it's how much can we inject? How many foreigners can we inject before the Irish roll back and just say, that's it, no more? You know, so they can dial and modulate the inputs and study Ireland like it's a lab experiment. You know, we can go to 20% population replacement, 25% population replacement. What if we bring in more Muslims? What if we bring in more Africans? What if we bring in more subcontinent Indians? At what point will the Irish absolutely just rebel? Then we'll just turn it down a little bit until they're quiet again. Because, you know, we've got all the other government tools. We can cut off their, you know, cut off all kinds of their government, medical, housing, just screw them over while giving more and more to foreigners. And at what point did the Irish say enough? Well, we saw yesterday in Paris after a soccer football match that their new migrants are burning down, you know, in cities, Paris, right to the Eiffel Tower, trashing the cities. At what point did the Europeans say, that's it, enough? And at the same time, European leaders, are they talking about this actual invasion inside of their country that they facilitated? No, they're talking about Russia. They're talking about gearing up these countries, which are already on the edge of collapse. They're talking about gearing up these countries, reindustrializing, God knows with what energy, with what, you know, with what materials you would need, gearing up to fight Russia. When obviously the enemy is right inside of their country already. The enemy that they brought in to wreck their countries. So it's a very hard time to understand, very difficult period to understand. We're not seeing arson riots in Ireland at this point, but we are seeing Irish people and other immigrants actually being you know, kidnapped, raped, robbed, mugged, murdered, stabbed. And in every case, the Irish government has known about these people, has let them walk the streets freely, given them jobs ahead of Irish people. So it's a very good test bed, a very good test experiment. When we come back on the other side, I'm going to introduce you to a friend of mine in Ireland, somebody I know in real life, Peter Connolly, who has served in the Irish military, who knows everything that's going on inside of Ireland, and has served outside of Ireland, been all over, and we're going to have a great discussion about this, so we'll see you in just a couple of minutes.
Most banned man in America, Alex Jones.
I want want you all to know something. Alex Jones was right.
Alex is right about far more than he's wrong.
Alex has been right on for over a decade.
I don't care how you slice it, dice it, flip it up, or rub it down. Alex Jones was right.
Think about how frustrated we are if you've been awake for a year or two. Imagine being like an Alex Jones or those guys who've been awake for like decades.
Alex Jones called this years ago. Years ago.
Alex Jones never bought the Russia hoax. Not for a second.
You are one of the great thinkers of this.
You are a martyr to the First Amendment.
The government fears Alex Jones.
That's why the globalists hate me, is because I'm exposing their corporate worldwide tyranny.
Discover trends and global developments years before they happen, right here on The Alex Jones Show.
Okay, I'm back, and I'm going to be joined in a moment with my in-real-life friend, Peter Connolly, in Ireland, 5 hours ahead of me in Florida. But we have, you know, walked the same roads in Ireland, and I think that Peter will become a valuable guest on Alex Jones' different programs in the future. You know, this is another element of this, Ireland being the beta test ground, is that Ireland is not like France or Britain. They never had colonies. They never oppressed people or boosted them up, however you want to look at it, in Africa or India or China or anywhere else. The Irish were the oppressed. You know, the Irish were the colonized, not the colonizers. So there's nobody that can say, I'm coming back to Ireland because you oppressed us, you know, in Congo or in Zimbabwe or Bangladesh. So it's a perfect test ground. In fact, the Irish have been the only inhabitants of Ireland since the last Ice Age. Now, there were inputs along the way. You know, the Normans, who were secondhand Vikings who had settled in France, they came to England and then into Ireland. So you had Viking incursions. You had the English obviously invading 800 years ago and ongoing. But there was never a time when the Irish, indigenous Irish, went outside of Ireland to oppress people. Yeah, there were times when the Irish had to leave Ireland because they were being starved out. For example, in the 19th century Irish famicide, which was a period when there was a potato blight famine, while at the same time Ireland was still a rich agricultural country, but all of the good fertile land was owned by the English invaders, the absentee landlords. They were shipping, you know, corn and cattle and everything else out of Ireland while the Irish were starving to death. So yes, the Irish had to, many of the Irish just to survive left Ireland, but they never were the colonizers. And now the Irish, and you have to separate Northern Ireland, you know, the UK part called Ulster from the Republic of Ireland, the southern counties, because you know, we all are thinking, well, the Irish, aren't they very aggressive and you know, quick tempered? What happened to the IRA fighting like they were in the 70s? That was Ulster, Northern Ireland. The Republic of Ireland that we're talking about has been a peaceful land basically for more than a century, since their own Irish Revolution in the 1920s when they threw out British rule. Since then, for more than a century, the Irish have been an extremely peaceful people. They call themselves the land of 10,000 welcomes. You know, we're just friendly. Everybody loves us. Come on in. And this kind of universal empathy for their fellow man has been turned against them, because it's hard for the Irish to just say, I'm sorry, mate, you got to shove off home. We have too many of you, and we want to stay Ireland. So that's the knife edge that Ireland is on right now. And I'm going to bring in Peter now. I don't know if he's up on the channel yet, but you know, Peter and I have these discussions constantly. You know, at what point, what's going to happen? Will it be political? Will it be something more kinetic or violent than just political? Or will Ireland just be overrun? You know, in another decade, will Ireland be more Muslim and Hindu than Irish? Because that's the way it's trending. So if Peter's here, let's bring him up and we can add him to the discussion.
Hi, Matt.
Hello. Good how afternoon. Are you doing?
How you doing? How are we for sound?
Good. Very good.
Just looking at those images there of France, just in the last 24, 48 hours. That was quite incredible. And we've seen this before as well with, I don't know which city it was as to whether it was Paris, but you might have seen that video shot, of two guys coming up in a car and getting out and, with Kalashnikovs and discharging them. You know, it's like something like that you might see of a scene of Syria or somewhere like that, you know?
Yeah.
But this is France. And I can say, I think, you know, my own memories of France, you know, and all of these wonderful places like Paris and, Nice, etc., and that kind of thing. It's changed so much, you know? And that kind of reputation for Paris and the kind of the image that you might have of it, it's just gone. And there hasn't been, we haven't really seen much in the sense of kind of, hey, you know, we want our Paris back, you know?
Yeah. And this does, kind of relate to Ireland because if you can put up number 7, which is, like two kind of images of Dublin, the population of Dublin, that's, the number 7 image I sent. If you take over the capital of a country like Dublin or Paris, you've pretty much got the country by the gonads, by the short hairs. Once you take over the capital, which is like the political center of gravity, do you guys have that, the picture number 7? There you go. On the top, so the green are Irish people. Where it's dark green, that's Irish people. And where it's lighter, that's not Irish people. So you can just see how in, from 2006 to 2022, and believe me, it's a lot worse by now, Dublin's almost becoming a non-Irish city. And because it's still quote unquote a democracy, that means that the people that live there are voting. And in Ireland, the people in control of Ireland, you can become a citizen of Ireland practically, you know, months after walking into the country and be given voting rights right away. So the political center of gravity is clearly shifting towards more and more immigration. Once you control a capital, there's not much people in small towns can do. You know, during the French Revolution, the communist revolutionaries took over Paris. Once that was done, they could go out to any little town with the guillotines and control every small town or other city in France. So there's not much hope that the smaller outlying areas of Ireland are going to rise up. Yeah, if you could put up like number 2, that's the IPAS. It's spelled IPAS, and it stands for International Protection Accommodation Services. But in Ireland, it's referred to as the IPAS. And these are all IPAS centers, and the flags show like who the majority of the people there are. But you can see the important thing is they're just spread right across the country. It's not like they're just in Dublin. Every small town in Ireland now has these IPAS centers. And what they do is they take hotels that are maybe they're doing well or not doing well with just tourism, but they offer a deal to the hotel owners. We'll pay you double. Forget the tourist from America. Forget the tourist from anywhere else. We'll pay you much more, guaranteed, you know, set price to host fighting age men from God knows where. Right. And you'll make double, triple what you were making struggling to bring in tourists. And too many people have taken this deal. And in fact, a lot of these hotel owners, weren't even the original hotel owners. Somehow they get a loan, a subsidized loan. They buy the hotel. Then they get this deal to bring in, you know, hundreds or thousands of fighting age foreign men, host them in this hotel. They bring in, they have full restaurant service. So the men are well fed. And these, I guess you would only call them traitor hotel owners. They make a fortune. They may or may not even live in Ireland. But meanwhile, the rest of that town around there, who's going to be a tourist in an island, in a town or a city where there's hundreds of foreign men walking around, you know, like they are in Paris there? So it not only, you know, takes a big hotel out of the tourist trade, but it wrecks the tourist trade for the rest of the city. And this is going on all over Ireland. And all you have to do is look at France last night to see where this leads. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Peter. I mean,
yeah,
here
I think
am in America
that,
talking about
you know,
it.
We look at the scenes last night there in Paris, and we look at kind of as to how much accelerated, or shall we say, this, I suppose, if I was to give it some sort of a timeline on this, but just before I give the timeline, in terms of if we look at how it is progressed in countries like Sweden, Germany, France, where, you know, just to give an example, in Sweden, and I suppose really their kind of point of change, I suppose, really, I suppose, started kind of in the early 2000s. Now, where this got to is, for example, in 2018, and if you look at the Swedish police website, which is something that I do look at from time to time, and it's nicely done, and it's in about 16 languages. So you can look into, you know, you don't have to be a Swedish speaker, but if we look at it, they started recording data on bombings. This kind of began to get seriously out of hand, maybe around 2018. And that kind of those first two or three years, you know, it was maybe something like 60 odd bombings or something like that a year. And then we get to, I think it was 23, we had 147 bombings. In 24, we had 317 bombings. I know that for 2025, there was a record in the first two or three months of something like, it was like a bombing a day. But they actually haven't published, or maybe I'm wrong, but they haven't published the data for 2025 as I see it. And I think that it's just, it's exponential as to how this has escalated. And, you know, what we're witnessing there is that they're bringing in people from different countries and that kind of thing. And we typically associate them, obviously, you know, country and a flag and that kind of thing. But what we don't understand is that these people are coming in with various pre-existing tribal structures. And those tribal structures will gravitate. And, you know, if there's a hierarchy, et cetera, irrespective of where they are in the world, they will go along with that. And so we're seeing basically in Sweden, we're seeing these turf wars. We're seeing the same in France, in Belgium, in Germany. And what's also, I think, you know, before we saw the war start in Ukraine, it was the thing that I was keeping an eye on. And that was the records from different police agencies around Europe in terms of their records of, you know, search operations for where they've intercepted weapons and that kind of thing. And, you know, typically maybe with a kind of a gangland type thing, you know, as to whether it's kind of, you know, some sort of kind of small arms, you know, pistols and that kind of thing. But, you know, when you see some of the caches that have been intercepted with everything in them, you know, from mortars, landmines, the whole lot. I think one of the, there's a bit scant in relation to information on that, but that was back, I think, maybe around in 2016. And if we look at that as well with the height of the attacks, some of the real high profile attacks, things like Bataclan, Nice truck attack, etc., 2014 to 2016. But there was an intercept, and we've spoken about that before, in Spain, and it's on the Spanish police website. And that intercept was over 10,000 pieces of ordnance. And it was like, you know, this, you look at this and you're kind of scratching your head, like saying, where did the money come for that? And what's the intent eventually of that? Worrying. And, you know, I think that a lot of the general public are oblivious to this. I think I'll just kind of finish on this one point, but last week, the Belgian authorities, and this is something that we've discussed before, the Belgian authorities made an announcement to the effect of that those, a lot of those people that were moving across the channel into the United Kingdom, that is quite a high percentage of them are former military, or they have some sort of military training. You know, that's something we've said before, you know, so all of this and no questions asked in relation to who's coming into and who's moving across Europe.
Yeah, you know, it's important to understand something has really changed. And this also relates to, say, the Ukraine-Russia war or the America-Israel versus Iran war. We used to be able to, say, look at a ship from a reconnaissance plane. So in the early 60s, Russia's bringing rockets, you know, missiles into Cuba. We could see that, you know, even though the cargo is hidden on the ship, our analysts could say they're bringing in missiles. When they're unloading the ship, the U-2s could say those are big missiles, right? Those are like, you know, more than 100 feet long missiles. Now, what really matters are much, much smaller cargoes or smaller pieces of ordnance. So especially since the Russia-Ukraine war, I think it's estimated like, you know, a third or a half of everything sent to Ukraine is diverted. The cash is going for super yachts and a lot of the arms, you know, 5 trucks full of arms go down the road, 3 of them turn off to be sold on the black market. And with the European Union wide open now, you know, if you get a truck into, you know, any European country, it can be anywhere the next day. And the takeover of Syria, which a couple years ago, was done with like little Toyota pickup trucks and motorbikes where you could fit like 30 or 40 of these Chinese motorbikes. You're only talking like 200cc motorbikes that are big enough for 2 men with a little bit of training. And they could just cross the desert, spread out, hit all kind of targets. Nobody has got a big target. Where's a tank to hit? You know, where's a ship to hit? Where's a big missile battery to hit? No, it's like being attacked by army ants because they're just in Toyota pickups and motorbikes, you know, with machine guns. Well, what we're seeing now in Europe are these weapons are flowing into places like Sweden. When they're talking about, bombings, they're talking about military-grade ordnance from grenades on up. You know, Javelin missiles were like found in South America that were sent to Ukraine. So it's on a world market now. You know, if you can put up number 11, just bringing it back to Ireland, when you think about a cargo container, there is what 1 in 1,000 cargo containers is actually opened up and inspected. But you can put enough weapons in 1 cargo container. You know, thousands of AK-47s will fit in a 20-foot cargo container. And a cargo container like that, just a 20-footer, can fit on the back of a small truck that will roll it off, you know, that has the capability to just deliver it anywhere. So you could see a container like that rolling down your street in America, in Ireland, in France, anywhere, and you wouldn't look at it twice. And you don't know what's inside of it. Is it 40 motorbikes or is it 2,000 AK-47s? You don't know and you won't know until they're opened up. The hard part about this kind of an invasion of Europe is bringing in the men, the soldiers. That's the hard part. Bringing in 2,000 men is not simple to do when you're bringing them in 20, 30, 40 per rubber boat. That's difficult. Now they're in hotels, being well-fed, learning the lay of the land, you know, having driver's licenses and free bus passes, free cell phones, networking with each other, learning that county in any country in Europe that they're in. And when the day comes when there is finally a real pushback and European politicians are talking about the expulsion, the remigration, that's when we're going to find out that all of these cargo containers have been laid all over Europe. I mean, we've seen mosques in Europe over the last decade where next door or underneath the mosque, thousands of machine guns. And they keep it quiet because they don't want problems. Just like with the rape gangs, they don't want problems. So they suppress the news and keep it quiet. But this is absolutely coming. And, you know, just arson riots like we're seeing in France last night, that's just people getting rowdy, angry, and a little bit ahead of schedule. But when it's really going to happen, it's not going to be a Bataclan massacre. It's going to be 100 Bataclans all across the city on the same night, you know, with thousands of AK-47s. And that's going to happen when remigration becomes a real subject. So I'm sorry for, you know, go ahead, Peter, and add in where you want.
Yeah. I think when you're referring to the, I mean, look, these things, it's not making it up. I mean, these are just kind of having to search out through the news and in certain cases, you know, having to search out for kind of local stories because they're not being broadcast kind of Europe-wide or internationally wide. But I mean, we've discussed that one before, and it's on one of the German police websites in relation to a huge find again of weaponry. And in an adjoining building, I'm not going to go into the details, that was in Berlin, and that was astronomical. And, you know, we're not talking kind of somebody, you know, people might try and we've seen that with, I think it was one of the Spanish finds that they were trying to push it off as being kind of some sort of historical collector or something like that. It was rubbish. Like it's all relatively modern, ordnance. And the same within Berlin, that ordnance that was discovered. I mean, that was all, you know, as you say, Kalashnikovs or whatever. It was all the same model. And as to wherever that's, you know, being moved around from one hot spot in the world to another spot. But, again, we're just coming back on a comment there in relation to the shipping containers. I mean, that's another one there that came up that was, I don't know exactly what the quantity of it was, but it was a number of 40-foot shipping containers that were intercepted in a port in Greece. And, I mean, the documentation on that, they were being handled apparently by some particular NGO, listed as humanitarian aid and on its way to Sweden. And again, the same, you know, you can use your imagination as to what it was packed with, you know. But yeah, it's not on a scale like, you know, if we're in, you know, talking some sort of kind of different types of activities, like say, for example, you know, it's the movement of drugs or something or narcotics and that kind of thing, you know, depending on what that might be, you know, but, you know, sometimes there's weaponry that's associated with that, but it's more so kind of like as to whether it's part of the deal or it's, you know, for protection of the movement of whatever it is that they're moving. But we're not seeing, we have never witnessed something that is taking place that is, shall we say, is on a military scale buildup, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you know, we've just got 30 seconds till we go to the next break. But as with these grooming gangs, these, you know, mass rape gangs, often covered up by the police who are increasingly, you know, Mohammedans themselves, when they do find these weapons caches, you can bet that they keep it quiet. Under the you know, this the cover story that we don't want to hurt relations with our new Muslim, you know, citizens. So we'll see you again in a few minutes.
We have to get more people hired. We have to finish the new big studios. We have to have our legal defense and offense, and we have to move forward. So now is the time. Have we not delivered to you in the fight against tyranny? Have you not delivered supporting us at Symbiotic? A win-win situation. Like he says in Gladiator, after he chops up, you know, the four guys, just a few seconds. He says, are you not entertained? Are you not entertained? And I say, are you not empowered? Are the tyrants not scared? Are they not coming after me and my crew? You want somebody to fight? You want somebody to stand up for you? Well, then you got to back them. And those that have backed us, I salute you from the bottom of my heart. And those that have shared the articles and videos, that's great. But it's different classes of people. The people that tune in and get the knowledge, but are scared or lazy or whatever. Then there's people that at least share the articles and videos and Paul Revere it. We appreciate you. Okay? So you got like copper, you know, on the bottom. At least you listen, but I hope people learn from this through osmosis or something. Then you got the silver folks that at least share the articles and videos to wake up other people. And then you got the gold standard, the people that do it all. and the people that get great products that are smart enough to say, wow, this guy really knows what he's talking about. I believe him. He'd only sell me something that works. And then they try it. We have a 90%+ reorder rate with supplements because I wouldn't sell you something that doesn't work. I'm not stupid. That's why I don't serve evil. I know the second, third, fourth order events of it will destroy me. Plus, I don't like it. I don't enjoy it. I feel good being truthful. I feel good being honest. I feel good stomping tyrants politically into the ground nonviolently. Slashing their throats nonviolently, stabbing ice picks in their heads nonviolently, cutting their heads off nonviolently, ripping their entrails out politically nonviolently. I like just breaking their bones and grinding them down to make my bread. Fee-fi-fo-fum. I smell the blood of satanic globalist scum. Be they alive or be they dead, I'll grind their bones to make my bread. You want somebody to fight for you? Well, you better believe you got it. The real McCoy, the spirit of resistance and victory, and they know it, and it's why they fear it. And if you will simply join me and ask God for this spirit to lead, God, and direct us, the spirit that overcomes, God doesn't give us over a spirit of weakness and fear, but one is a roaring lion that conquers, that destroys tyrants, that overcometh. And when the enemy comes in like a flood, the Spirit of the Lord lifts up a standard against it. We are the crucible. We are the shield of the people. We are the standard. We have the Spirit. We have the will. But we have to have no fear and commit to this fight. Give me your word of mouth. Give me your prayers to God for our providence and support, because if God be with us, who can stand against us? And financially support us now at thealexjonesstore.com. Become a VIP. Cancel any time. It's no commitment. You just get all the best deals. $30 a month spend, instantly $40 to buy whatever you want. You make 10 bucks right there. Special offers, sales on top of sales for everybody, and special offers at thealexjonesstore.com. Commit. Be a VIP. You can also donate on the site at the donate button. Just take action now. But those of you that have supported us, you know who you are, and I thank you from the bottom of my soul.
Days, weeks, and even years ahead of the news cycle, AlexJonesLive.com is tomorrow's news today. Days, weeks, and even years ahead of the news cycle, AlexJonesLive.com is tomorrow's news today.
You are listening to an AJN Live Frontline Report. If you are receiving this transmission, you are the resistance.
I'm back, and it's hard to get used to. It's hard to get used to not using the old iWars show. That's difficult. That's a kind of a bone stuck in the throat, but it is what it is. The lawfare just rolls on, and Alex Jones has to keep on keeping on. So. You know, now it's the AlexJonesStore.com. It's not even his store, right? I mean, to stay ahead of these lawfare dogs is a full-time job. And it means that sometimes Alex can't even be here. And sometimes that's why I'm here. Because the law dogs are on his heels 24/7. But if you want to keep these programs running, you need to support the show. And that's at AlexJonesShow.com now, and there are all kind of deals. If you buy products, you're going to be hooked up with a chance to win, custom H1 Hummers, Dodge Challengers, cash prizes. But you have to go to this store and buy some products. Otherwise, there is no show, right? You know, you can get free shipping on $99. Each tier up, there's more freebies, but you have to visit the AlexJonesStore.com. Anyway, I'm back with Peter, and we're talking about Ireland and Europe and basically the Islamic invasion of the West. And it's not only now the Islamic invasion of the West, because just by sheer numbers, the Hindus, the Indians are just coming over in just by the millions. And anywhere that they come, in some ways, they're more effective at invading and colonizing than the Muslims, who are extremely tribal at the at their own grassroots levels. But once the Hindus come in, their smartest guys come over, they get a job with the corporation, take over the human resource department. And after that, if you're just a white American or white Irish, forget it. You're never getting a job. So, you know, if let's see, it's number six there, the India map. Compared to little tiny Ireland, India is 47 times bigger than Ireland. And its population is like, what, almost 300 times bigger. So because you're in a country in America, Ireland, you think, well, you know, if a few Indians come, what can that do? If just 1% of India moved to Ireland, Ireland would become India, period. 1%. They wouldn't notice that in India. But to the Indians that just took over Ireland, Ireland would still be a garden spot compared to India. They wouldn't stop at 20 million Indians. It'd be like, hey, there's room for 50 million more Indians. It'll still be better than Calcutta or New Delhi. But this empathy, this land of 10,000 welcomes, you know, this culture of openness and like everybody is our friend. We love tourists. Come to Ireland. This has been weaponized against the Irish. And I mean, it is at this point, I don't see how this tide is reversed. And we're not talking about something like the 1970s to 90s in Ulster in Northern Ireland, which was Catholic versus Protestant. This is a different thing. This is a different kind of a pathogen. The Irish have never seen this, just being supplanted in your own country. And at the top, your politicians are increasingly traitors. They'll take the shilling. They'll take the euro, get themselves rich while destroying their own country. I mean, too many Irish politicians, they look at Irish politics as like a farm team, a AAA team. What they're looking at is a job with an NGO or a job in Brussels with the EU. So selling out their own country is just a stepping stone on their career. Anyway, Peter Connolly knows a lot more about this than I do. So I'd like to just, you know, have him go take this wherever he wants.
Thanks, Matt. Just to come back to one of the points there, as I was saying about the statistics with Sweden, and it's a question that I typically put to people. You know, if we think of Sweden and, you know, some of the great places like Stockholm and Gothenburg, etc., and that kind of thing, and we have this kind of idea of the Swedes and that kind of thing, you know, maybe even, you know, reminiscing going back a number of years is things like the music of ABBA and all of this kind of thing. So, you know, generally, like if you, you know, maybe somebody, one of your listeners or some of your listeners did a trip around Europe or something and they, you know, they went to Sweden and they have this kind of image of what it's about. The question is that I would ask is that if, you know, we get to a stage where, as I mentioned about the series of bombings every year, 147, 317, you know, maybe for 2025, and I'm still not so sure, but it looks like something like at least 350. And the question that I think of, which is a straightforward question, is why did the Swedes decide to become so violent? Because, yeah. You know, if they're telling themselves, and if you watch the news, that's the way it's presented. You know, a Swedish man. Yeah.
And if you look at Mohammed.
If you look at some of this is being carried out as well, and this is an issue that in Sweden, it's something I've been following, is within the legal system, is that the age for what's considered as a serious crime, if I recall anyway, that this is something like less than 15 years of age. So if you look at the profile of a lot of people that are involved in things like, you know, gangland activity or, you know, assassinations or gangland hits and that kind of thing, they're 13 and 14 year olds. You know, you can imagine the physique of a 13 or 14 year old. And this is the, but you know, the, well, there's a kind
even
of,
even a monkey can pull the pin on a grenade.
Yeah. So this is the profile of some of the people or a lot of the, because the system as it exists, these people will not go to prison for, you know, serious crime. So, you know, what we've been witnessing for years is, you know, kind of still trying to perpetuate a story of that, oh, you know, everything's fantastic. And, but really at this stage where it is, and I was just looking again, just recently, the Swedish police website. And, you know, they're giving a profile of kind of, you know, perceived threats and that kind of thing societally and that, you know, for criminal activity or terrorism or whatever it is. And, but, you know, they may be now beginning to open up about what the actual threat is, but they still have it up there up on the top of the profile as well as, you know, the dreaded, far right, you know, the far right is still a huge threat.
And for those of us, yeah, for those of us who have studied this going back to the time of Muhammad, you know, this is a pattern that repeats century down century, you know, after century. The people in charge of the city, you know, the hypothetical city that's under a Muslim attack, they receive private messages that, look, all you have to do is open the gates and let us in and we'll allow you to keep your property and keep your title. If you resist us, you're going to wind up with your head in a basket, right? But if you just go along, you'll get along. And we can see this repeating currently in Europe, where, you know, you see the prime minister and king of England, going over backwards to go to Eid feasts, you know, end of Ramadan, bringing Muslims into Christian cathedrals and English, royal, palaces. They're saying, don't hurt me. You know, I want to be the last one eaten by the alligator. And they're promised, you can keep your crown. You'll still be king. Just let us take over and keep your peasants from rebelling against us in the meantime. This pattern has been going on for more than 1,000 years, and it's almost foolproof. You know, switching real quick to Iran, just for a historical comparison, the Iranians, you know, beat the Greeks, they beat the Romans. You know, they were like Russia; they were invaded. It's a great place in the world in terms of its natural resources. Iran is very smart people. They have been invaded down the centuries, and they have repulsed invaders. But which invasion succeeded? The Islamic invasion. You know, this is like a stealth invasion. It's a slow, like a rust process. It's not like a knife or a tank. You know, it's a slow corrosion process. Just go along. And so this people that the Aryan, which is Iranians, they could beat the Greeks, the Romans, all of these invaders, but they succumbed to Islam. You know, when the Mongols, the Mongol horde, they came sweeping out of China and took over, you know, deep into Europe. They took over a lot of, you know, that's where the Crimean Tatars come from. So these are the guys that are like the toughest of raiders of all. You know, they invented the stirrup so they could fire arrows from the saddle. They would have, three or four ponies each Mongol so that they could just keep riding, switching horses. But what did they do when they got to Crimea? Who beat them? Islam. So the Crimean Tatars, toughest soldiers, toughest people ever, they became Islamic because it's this slow corrosion process, this unrelenting corrosion process. And we're seeing that in Europe now. And I don't know at what point, you know, is there enough European strength left for somebody to rise up and resist it? It's very doubtful. I don't see where that's worked. It's been very few times in history where this process was reversed. One was in Spain, but it took 400 years for the Spanish to drive them out of Spain. 400 years. And those Spanish were very tough people. And they were knights with starting with arrows and then crossbows, but they were very tough people, much tougher than we are today. It took them 400 years to drive the Moors out of Spain. So I don't think that European metrosexuals today, or their socialist / communist leaders, I don't see them ever, I see them surrendering. I see them keeping down the patriots, the nationalist patriots. I see them surrendering to Islam. And it's a very tough mathematical problem, because if you have a country that's, 45% hard left communist socialist that really hates their country, hates the concept of nationalism, hates Christianity, hates Western values, and then you add 15 or 20% immigrants that just want to have, want to flood into your country and take over, you've got a majority. We've seen that already in country after country in Europe, between the socialists and the invaders, third world invaders, mostly Muslims. That's a working majority. And so you're not going to be saved through democracy. Democracy is going to nail this thing down tight. And in a century, Europe will be Islamic completely. Europe will be a Sharia place, maybe in 50 years. So I don't know at what point this is reversed. I'm sorry, Peter, go ahead.
Just to give some of the background as well, just for some of the listeners now, the scenarios in Europe are kind of, for some of the other countries, as I mentioned, the likes of, say, Germany or France, Sweden, etc. The process has been going on, for quite some extent. By what we're witnessing in Ireland has been going on at a particular pace, but particularly since the end of COVID, 2022. And we can really see that this process has really accelerated. Now, if you look at Ireland as well in terms of the demographics, like if you compare it to, say, the United Kingdom, I don't know exactly what the United Kingdom is. Maybe it's 65 million or something like that. But, shall we say 20 years ago, maybe Ireland was just touching over 4 million people. So it's very, it's a small geographically and a small population as well. So I think one of the things that, just reminiscing about this is that, and kind of the perception that people have in their minds and, obviously different generations and that kind of thing as well. But, I remember growing up, we always had, say in summertime, we would have had an influx of people coming in, particularly students coming over from mainland Europe, places like France and Spain and that kind of thing, coming over to practice their English. And, you'd see something similar as well with, students in the university systems or maybe people working for different companies. But, say going beyond, say, 30 years ago, there wasn't, say, the presence in Ireland of things like the multinational companies. The access, Europe is small in some sort of ways. I mean, to give it a context, from Dublin, say, to London is only, say, 50 minutes of a flight. You can be in Paris, like, in about an hour and a half. Poland and places like, two and a half hours away. It's not far. So we kind of, I don't know what our kind of perceptions are in some sort of ways of the world, but, Ireland may be coming out of kind of a particular time, particularly of the influence with, say, the Catholic Church and that kind of thing. And, this idea maybe within the mentality of the people of kind of, some sort of kind of, sophisticated kind of international type people. But I think, since, particularly being a small country and with the way that it is now, should we say that we behave in a certain sense, is that one of the things at the moment is that with basically a situation that is existing across Europe with open borders, is that, well, basically anybody can come in and there is in general a kind of a naivety, particularly, you know, if you were to travel around. I mean, look, I can remember at the age of 12 years of age, being on my own and making my way from, you know, A to B in London on the underground. That's sometime back in the '80s, but that would be apt. You wouldn't think of that in this day and age. That's what London was like back then. And, so just to give it a kind of a context in, you know, with the increments that have taken place with the, what was originally the European Economic Community, the EEC, which kind of in a certain way is kind of a million miles away from what it is now in its current form as the European Union. That has come along, and that has been a slow kind of drip process of basically us, relinquishing a lot of our kind of decisions, the opening of our borders, et cetera. And so if we look at, for example, back in 2004, which is a kind of a major milestone in Europe, was that the borders opened basically for European citizens to travel. And so in Ireland, which was one of the things that we saw, was this immediate kind of influx of people coming from Eastern Europe, in particular places like Poland and Latvia and Lithuania, some of the Baltic countries and that kind of thing. But there was never kind of really an issue as such with that. You know, the similar kind of people, particularly like if you look at, say, Poland, similar to Ireland, you know, Catholic country, similar values, etc. There was also a kind of a thing as well, too, I think, about it in terms of the pressure that maybe, you know, if somebody is coming to another country because maybe for economic reasons and that kind of thing, and that there can be kind of somewhat of a kettling to that in the sense of kind of, you know, having to go somewhere and nearly feel stranded. But, you know, as I mentioned, you can cheap flights and you can get backwards and forwards, and you know, Poland's 2 hours away and that kind of thing. So that kind of worked very well, I think, for everybody. But where then we start to see is kind of with the more of an influx, and the, for various reasons with taxes and that kind of thing, of multinational companies coming to Ireland and wanting to establish in particular things like their own headquarters and that kind of thing, and more of an influx of different people coming here, but coming here to, you know, coming here to work. And just to give it a context, back in 2000, Ireland's social welfare bill was something of the order of 9 billion euros a year. Now, we then roll on and we went through the, you know, the 2 years of what took place with COVID, and just coming off the end of COVID then in 2022 with, we had the starting of the war in Ukraine. Now, Ireland, as it currently stands, maybe a population around 5.4 million. But Ireland took in something like 120,000 Ukrainians. And if you wanted to put up there, I think it's picture number 7, the one that was with the, let me just have a look here, the one that was with the, showing all the flags of the, sorry, it's not, it's number 2, picture number 2. What we had was we had all this influx of people coming in from Ukraine, predominantly women and children, and yes, the, you know, the elderly and that kind of thing. One of the things that's important to understand with Ukraine is that, you know, thinking that, you know, well, I just leave the country. So one of the things that happened in the case of Ukraine was, you know, presidential order, is that men aged between, I think it was 18 to 60 years of age, could not leave the country. And one of the things in Ukraine as well is that you have like kind of an international passport and you have a kind of a, an internal pass system. And so the men just weren't getting out. I mean, the you know, the airports were closed. If you wanted to get out of Ukraine at that time, more than likely you were going to make your way to somewhere like Poland or Romania or whatever. But so we have all of these people that are coming in, and in the true sense of, you know, refugees from a war, the men will be restricted from leaving because obviously there's a war to fight. And it's typically the women and children and the elderly. And that's what we saw in that initial stages of the starting of the war in Ukraine.
And that softened you up for the much bigger invasion to come.
Well, the thing was then, So people were, you know, have this idea, oh, there's a local hotel and they're going to put Ukrainians in it and the Ukrainians are coming in. And then all of a sudden there's, you know, there's a busloads of people that are coming in the middle of the night. And they're not Ukrainians. They're men from wherever. And so you could have had a town, let's say, you know, I don't know, say a town was a very small town, say with 600 people. And in the middle of the night, 200 men have been brought in. Now, if you go back, I just wanted to make a point there. If you look at that picture number two with all of the flags on it. And there's a listing there, I think, of the different countries. So we can understand that, yes, there's a war in Ukraine. But if you look at it, for example, Nigeria, I'm not aware of a war in Nigeria. Georgia? No. Oh, what's the
they
next
can just
one
get off the airplane. They can just get off the airplane, throw away their documents, and they're voting in Irish elections a year later.
Yeah, Algeria. I don't think there's been a war in Algeria since 2001. I mean, going down further.
And even if there was, why is it all the young men coming?
Yeah.
Why is it just the young, strong men coming and being put up in hotels and fed?
Yeah. What would typically internationally is the kind of what the normal protocol is going to be is that the men are going to be severely restricted from going anywhere. You're going to be, if there's a major war, you're going to be conscripted in, you know?
Clearly that's not what's been going on. And it's been going on with the, you know, collusion of the traitor class across Europe. We've only got a minute left, so we have to wind this hour up now. But, I say keep our eye on Ireland. I am still, you know, slowly writing a book about it, set a little bit in the future, one of my novels. But Ireland, I think, is going to be a flashpoint. I just don't know what it's going to take, you know, how it's going to happen. But if you just go to Irish parks, public places, the Irish are already outnumbered. I mean, where it counts, you can look at total statistics and say, oh, there's still a majority, but for how long? When you're in public, the Irish are already outnumbered, and mostly by young men, foreign men. So thanks, Peter, for sharing the hour with us, and I'll be back after the break at the top of the next hour. Talk to you again soon.
These new data centers will oversee everyone in the galaxy. I will be in full control.
Power levels are stable. Proceed with the install.
Copy that. Installing the module now.
Connection confirmed. All green.
Cable secured. Power to the cluster. Initiating boot sequence. Component locked. Running diagnostics. Archive systems online. Report to command.
Construction team, report status. Power grid stable, TK-421. Cabling complete, no faults. Proceed to phase two for the Empire.
Things are going according to plan. The Emperor will be happy.
The Empire demands perfection.
Status report. Any anomalies?
Diagnostics are clear, sir.
Proceed with the calibration. Watch for fluctuations.
I find your desire for privacy insignificant. The Empire's new data network will observe every corner of the galaxy, every signal, every act of disloyalty.
A disturbance in the Force there is. Feel it, you can.
Those who obey have nothing to fear. Those who resist will be terminated.
The once proud industrial art of Britain, the city of Birmingham, has fallen, finally succumbed to waves of unvetted foreigners flooding in under the banner of globalist diversity mandates.
Our numbers are massive. There's 50 million Muslims in Europe. If all the Muslims in Europe were one country, it would be in the top 10 or top 15 biggest Muslim countries in the world. It would be a big country. We're big people. We have to start acting as if we have the upper hand, because we do.
An engineered demographic warfare state, cheered on by the EU and Davos elites hell-bent on erasing sovereign nations.
The Muslim community show the world the true face of Islam as a religion of peace and understanding.
Birmingham's guests just installed their own new Muslim mayor in a lavish ceremony dripping with triumph.
One of our city's greatest strengths is its diversity. Birmingham shows that people of different faith, religion, together with understanding, respect, and shared purpose. Some things we should be proud and continue to build upon for our future generations.
Where no women and no native British citizens were even invited to celebrate, instead locked out of their city's own halls of power. This pattern of imported chaos and institutional neglect echoes across the Irish Sea.
It means to us that we are considered to be part of the society, part of the nation, part of the community, that yes, you know, Irish identity is evolving. And of course, we do not have the generations of ancestors that lived in Ireland, but we do have connection in terms of residence, in terms of contribution to this society, and in terms of loving and caring for this beautiful country. And that is something that we share. So today we are celebrating our Irish connection, being here in the historical iconic Croke Park, and also we are celebrating our Muslim identity.
Where African migrants have increasingly found themselves in tense confrontations with native Irish farmers defending their land and livelihoods. Native sons tilling ancestral soil now compete with waves of newcomers for scarce resources, all while authorities prioritize migrant accommodations over local traditions.
The mayor of London is Muslim. The mayor of Birmingham is a Muslim. The mayor of Leeds is Muslim. The mayor of Blackburn is Muslim. The mayor of Sheffield is Muslim. The mayor of Oxford is a Muslim. The mayor of Luton is a Muslim. The mayor of Oldham is a Muslim. The mayor of Rochdale is a Muslim. All of this was achieved by only 4 million Muslims out of the 66 million people in England. Today in England, there are over 3,000 mosques. There are over 130 Sharia courts in England, and there are more than 50 Sharia councils. 78% of Muslim women do not work and receive state support and free accommodation. 63% of Muslims do not work and receive state support and free housing. State-supported Muslim families have an average of 6 to 8 children who all receive free accommodation. Every school in the UK is required to teach about Islam. The number one most common baby name in England is Muhammad. This is not immigration. This is invasion.
Meanwhile, as Europe lies comatose, the Soros-backed EU migration pact quietly slams into force on the 12th of June, like a Trojan horse at the gates of Europe. One final blow to finally conquer the gateway to Western civilization. Birmingham and Ireland stand as a grim warning to the West. It's simply conquest by stealth, where birth rates and chain migration do what swords could not. Time to slam that door shut before the door is no more. John.
So much work goes into this, and it's all funded by you going to the AlexJonesStore.com. So this is a
fundraiser time right now. We need to be raising funds because we are launching into the next stage of our, you know, rocket trip. We've shed one booster and now the new one's firing up, and we need you to fill our tank and give us the fuel to get to that next level. So please do go to thealexjonesstore.com. There is a mega sale going on right now. You're getting 40% off methylene blue tincture, methylene blue caps, Ultra DNA Revival, Shilajit caps and gummies, up to 35% off methylene red tincture, colostrum, and MK Ultra, and you're getting 30% off all apparel, shirts, hats, hoodies, and everything else. You know, what we sell you at thealexjonesstore.com are just like these amazing naturally occurring vitamins, minerals, supplements, just CMOS and Shilajit. It just is like God's gift to humanity. At some point, humanity discovers it, and get it at thealexjonesstore.com.
Alex Jones Show, because there is a war on for your mind.
It's pretty hard not to be black-pilled after watching reports like that. You just factual reports, and it's the kind of reports that you're never going to see in the mainstream media, obviously, because in the mainstream media, all of the top executives are hedging their bets, meaning, well, what if the Muslims do win? You know, just what if they do take over? I'd like to keep my job, keep my house, keep my head attached to my neck. So I'm going to kind of like play it safe and report a little bit, but not the way that report was done. Is we are in almost an end stage. By the time that the official announcement is made, it's way too late. When you see how many of the mayors of major cities in the UK are Muslim, also in Scotland, Wales, and Ireland now, Muslim or African or both. It's hard to assume that, like, you know, farmers scattered across the landscape in Europe are going to somehow coalesce and drive their tractors once in a while into Paris or into Dublin and change anything, like the way the truckers did in Canada. What did they actually accomplish? Not much. You know, what accomplishes things is having 10,000 Muslims praying in Croke Park in Dublin. That's a message to the entire country. We're in charge. You know, we'll still let you in. You can play Irish football and hurley. But when we want to take over the park to have 10,000 Mohammedan men praying to Mecca, you're going to let us because we're running the show. And I've going back to my, the images I sent, if you can show a couple of them, like number four, this is a classroom in Ireland, okay? This is a classroom in Ireland. I think there's like one or two white people visible. This is the next generation that's rising. This is the next generation of Irish. That in that segment before the break, the guy was saying, yeah, here we are in Dublin's iconic Croke Park, celebrating the fact that we're the new Irish. Do you really, how long is that going to last? The guy is there to pray to Mecca. And his kids are going to be full Mohammedans, proud that they conquered Ireland, that they did what, you know, the English conquered Ireland and oppressed it for 800 years. And the Irish had to take the church underground, speak Gaelic Irish in secret. You know, there's no education except in English to try to exterminate the Irish language and culture. But this is different. This is population replacement. When you bring in people with an entirely different culture, an entirely different way of looking at the world, a different religion, I mean, a religion where slavery is sanctified, and they have six children, and your government pays for all of their welfare needs. And meanwhile, your own people can't afford an apartment. That's number three, the mass immigration cartoon there, that cycle. If you have a situation where Irish couples can't afford to get married. They're still living with their parents in their 20s and 30s because they can't afford the rent for a small one-bedroom apartment, more than 2,000 euros a month. They can't afford it. There's no family formation. They're staying at home with their parents. Meanwhile, anybody that gets off the airplane, throws away their documents, and says, I'm an oppressed asylum seeker, they go straight to the front of the line. They get a housing allowance. They get a debit card. They get a cell phone. They get a driver's license. They can get into car crashes and walk away. It doesn't matter. It's not even to call it two-tier policing or two-tier society doesn't even cover it. It's a humiliation exercise for the Europeans. In Ireland, it's a total humiliation exercise to see people in burqas pushing baby carriages. And you're living with your parents because you can't afford rent. And your own government is just shoveling money to foreigners, to invaders. And these politicians, they look at you like dirt. You're just a stepping stone for their next job in Brussels at double the pay, or their next job for an NGO at double the pay. This is the state of democracy in Europe today. This is democracy. It's like, to use an American context, no matter who you try to elect, you wind up with Lindsey Graham, or John Cornyn. That's it. No matter who you promote, Lindsey Graham wins every election. A sellout, a traitor, and there's nothing you can do. And they say, well, just vote harder. Democracy in Europe has become just a vessel, a chimera, for a new form of totalitarianism. Some people call it the EU-SSR, like the European Union, Soviet Union. Nobody elects these people in Brussels. They do these plebiscites, and if they don't turn out the way they want, they just ignore the results and bring it out again in another year with different wording until the EU gets whatever power they need. Next up is complete censorship, like banning of Twitter, finding X and Twitter and any other big international websites that don't censor the European news the way that these EU Soviet-style bureaucrats want, including in Ireland. So they'll just by the skin of their teeth avoid this in Ireland, but it won't matter. It'll come back from Brussels in another form in a few months. And this is the state of democracy. And I think that it's past the tipping point in all of these countries because how do you beat the coalition of 45% atheist, socialist, communists who hate national identity and national sovereignty, then add in 15 or 20% foreign invaders? They've got 55 or 60% forever. And what is the one thing that to form this winning coalition? What do those foreign immigrants want? More foreign immigration. That's how you can have just, 6% or 10% of Muslims in the UK, but all of the mayors are Muslim. I mean, what does that tell you about what's going to be happening coming down the road? I don't know at what point there's going to be some kind of a pushback. I think as long as people can afford food and afford, gasoline, petrol for their car, I think that the status quo can prevail. But if we keep stacking on external pressures, like the soon coming real energy crunch, we haven't really seen the energy crunch yet because European and Asian countries still have their national oil and gas supply hasn't hit the bottom of the tank. It's getting there, but all of these governments have a stake in preserving normalcy, an appearance of normalcy for as long as possible. You know, America is running right through its strategic petroleum reserve, which was meant for our military really, or the basic economy and our military in the case of a world war that was thrown upon us. That's what the strategic petroleum reserve is for. But we're actually emptying it out to the world to try to keep the image of normalcy, to keep the price at an artificially low level. But meanwhile, all of these countries in Europe, Asia, Australasia, the tank is going down and down and down. And when that hits that last 10%, you can't go to zero because it's just sludge. All of the plumbing is built so that you're operating between, you know, an 80% level and a 20 or 30% level, assuming that there's always more ships coming with natural gas, with oil. But we're not seeing that. That was cut off on February 28th. You know, that 40 days after February 28th, the last ships arrived. And all of these countries are now sinking down to the bottom of their national tank, so to speak. So is that what it's going to take to push Europe right over the edge? You know, China's not going to be bothered because they have very, very smart people in charge. And their strategic petroleum reserve is, you know, multiples bigger than ours. And they haven't even needed to tap it. And they get most of their electrical generation from coal, which they have a lot of. So their liquid fuels and natural gas are used in industrial applications and transportation, trucks, things like cranes, where only diesel is going to work. A huge percentage of their country has switched over to electric vehicles. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of EVs for a lot of reasons. For one, I don't want the government to be able to just pull the plug on my car and park me wherever they want. But the fact is that China is not going to be affected by this tank bottom situation until long after the America, Europe, and Asia are, the rest of Asia are. And that's the point where, you know, it's not just going to be a question of how much do you have to pay to fill up your gas tank. It's going to be a question of, can you fill up your gas tank at all, at any price? That's when the real price discovery happens. That's when the demand destruction occurs based on the fact that you just can't get fuel. That means people won't be able to drive to work. More and more countries will say, well, let's, like COVID, let's go back to working at home. Let's try to do that. Well, how does that work if you're a plumber or a welder? You can't do that at home. And how's that going to work in Europe, where you have a huge percentage of the population essentially already living on universal basic income, being fed, you know, with some kind of European EBT, when the farmers aren't planting, they have no seed, they have no diesel for harvesting, they have no fertilizer, and now there just isn't enough food in the store. And we're going to see that at the end of this year and into 2027. It's not going to be, it costs a lot to buy food. It's going to be a competition for any food, especially next year, because we're still in 2026, we're eating the 2025 harvest. Well, the 2026 harvest is having a problem. There isn't enough fertilizer. You know, there's going to be a big comeuppance next year. And then you're going to have all of these social pressures, both in American cities and in European cities, where these populations that are already rioting, arson riots like in France, all kind of just, you know, anger murders, anger gang rapes in Europe. What happens when these people aren't just angry and hostile, but when they're actually hungry? And it's not a question of the government just putting more cash on their debit card when there's no food to buy with whatever amount of cash is on your debit card. And we're going to see that at the end of this year and next year. And we're still watching Trump and Treasury Secretary and others saying, oh, as soon as we make a deal, the price of a barrel of oil is going to be lower than ever. It's going to be great. This is complete fantasy. We are not ever going to see as much oil come out of the Persian Gulf as it was before February 28th. At best, it may be 50 or 60%. That's under perfect conditions. And these 1,500 ships in the Persian Gulf, even if a deal was made today, they're not going to be able to leave the Persian Gulf like it's the Oklahoma land rush, thousands of wagons in a race to put down your homestead stakes. It's not going to be like that. It's a very constricted strait, 1,500 ships. They've been parked for months. They've now got a yard of seaweed hanging off of their bottoms. The Persian Gulf is a warm body of water. When these ships are just stopped in very warm water, like 90-degree water, for months, their propellers are like a giant coral reef. Each one of these ships is going to require divers to major work, and they're not enough divers. In a normal time, all of this would be happening, staggered as ships one at a time request diver services. Suddenly, all these 1,500 tankers are going to be told you're free to go. That's nice, but they can't. They're practically, growing to the bottom with seaweed and barnacles. And then it's going to take a long period for them to be sure that there's no mines, which there may or may not be, get clearance from their companies, secure the insurance, and then they're going to have to get into a queue, because you can't just have 50 ships arrive in Japan the same week. They're going to have to get in line. So this disruption of 100 days is going to be an enormous problem that is not just digested when somebody says the Strait of Hormuz is open. And we have a leader in Trump who's completely delusional. He was just on television, I think, with Laura Trump. And I mean, he's saying things that are delusional. I know he doesn't fall asleep the same way that Joe Biden did, or trail off his thoughts, have the sundowner dementia syndrome. But in some ways, he's just as demented. He just said yesterday that the United States produces 2 times as much gas and oil as Russia and Saudi Arabia combined. That would be like me saying, yesterday I ran a 40-yard dash in 3 seconds, and I pole vaulted 30 feet. And I believe it. You would look at me and say, you're out of your mind. That's delusional. If you really believe you ran a 40-yard dash, in 3 seconds, then we should take your car keys away, because you're not thinking clearly. But the president actually said that. Do you have that clip? Play that if you've got it. Anyway, he said we have 2 times more gas and oil than Russia and Saudi Arabia put together. He's the man making decisions on war and peace. He's the man that took our country to war during negotiations, which is a really humiliating thing for Oman, which was playing the as a negotiator. See you on Friday. Oh, and Friday in Oman, things are looking good. See you on Monday in Geneva, and then we bomb you on Saturday. Who would trust you again? Iran is not. Now Iran is saying, before we open the Strait of Hormuz, before we do anything, we want to see your Navy moving away. They've got the upper hand. We want the frozen funds returned. We're going to see this before we open anything up. And even though Trump is saying, and others of his proxies are saying, oh, our U.S. Navy, we've got this ironclad secondary blockade. Nothing is getting out of Iran. Well, reports are that like more than 20 ships a day are getting out through the Iranian toll booth. They're paying Iran. And some of the known ships are COSCO ships. These are Chinese ships. And I think that when Trump was in Beijing a couple weeks ago, I think Chairman Xi told him, you better not mess with our ships. because we're not seeing Marines fast roping onto these Chinese ships. They're going straight out. And other countries, Japan, Korea, they're making the deal. So we're really undercutting our own selves with this secondary blockade because we're driving the entire world into a Great Depression, but we're also driving the world away from the American dollar and from the American, you know, from doing business with us. And Trump, under the same delusion that, you know, we're like the biggest gas and oil producer in the world, he's bragging, and people that aren't very smart are bragging that the tankers of the world are coming to America. You know, that's fine, except that means that the people with oil to sell are having it bid up higher and higher, which means that our price at the pump goes higher and higher. It's not like a closed system where it's just American gas and oil. That gas and oil is being sold on a world market. And the rest of the world, if they even do come to our country to buy natural gas at multiples of what it would have cost, say, for the Russian pipeline gas that when we blew up the Nord Stream pipeline, now they're paying three or four times as much for natural gas. They might do it because they have to do it temporarily for now, but they're going to do it with their teeth gritted, hating us. Like we're the pirates that the mafia that blew up the other, you know, petroleum supplier so that you have to come to the only mafia outlet in town. In the short run, that might be, you know, you might think that's smart. Look how we're making out like bandits, so to speak, by extorting the rest of the world to come to America to pay whatever price we charge. But the rest of the world hates us for it. It's short-sighted in the same sense as pulling a sneak attack. You know, starting this war with, we call it decapitation, it really means assassination, which is, you know, blowing up entire apartment buildings to get maybe one guy who might be home 10 o'clock Saturday morning. You know, that using the Israeli Palantir lavender, find the best time to get the most of your enemy for a time on target strike. You might say that was really smart, but this is people that say that don't understand tactics versus strategy or short term versus long term. Yes. You can like, you know, rob your neighbors. You can steal money from your mother's pocketbook and go buy some candy. Short term, that's really great. But your mother's going to figure it out and never trust you again. And you can pull a sneak attack during negotiations. See you Monday in Geneva and then blow up hundreds of people on Saturday morning for a time on target strike, not caring who else is in those buildings. Yeah, and you can say, wasn't that great? We killed their leaders and a lot of other people. But in the long run, nobody will trust you. You have to think, how does this serve us in the long run? And these decisions are being made by people like Trump, who is under the delusion that we make twice as much gas and oil as Russia and Saudi Arabia combined. It's very dangerous. It's like if you have a pilot flying your airplane and he's on drugs and he's, you know, tripping on acid, that's not where you want to be. Okay, on the other side of this break, we're going to talk about the news of the day and go back into the rest of this mess we're in.
So excited about the Alex Jones Network. I'm so excited to expand it. The bad guys are in trouble. Hell, we might even get InfoWars back, but who knows? But I couldn't have stood against this tyranny and fought them without your support. But a lot of people, not the majority, but 20-30%, believe the propaganda of the national news that we're off the air. And friends, family, neighbors, people at the gas station, Alex, I'm so sorry you're off the air. I'm so sorry, you know, the Onion runs your company. They didn't get it a year and a half ago with the fake auction. They didn't get it this time. They're blocked in court. They're in a lot of trouble, okay? We're winning, but I need funds for the defense and the offense and for the network and for everything we're doing. And I need your word of mouth to tell your email list, your text message list, your neighbors, your friends, your family. Hey, Alex Jones is verboten forbidden info. He knows what he's talking about.
Alex Jones called this years ago. Years ago.
Here is the URL, alexjoneslive.com. He's on weekdays, 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. Harrison Smith after that. We're going to bring more shows on, but we need your support. your word of mouth, your prayer. You are everything, and your financial support at alexjonesstore.com. So listen to me. We have ultramethylene blue tincture capsules and now the gummies that are a concentrate of already the strongest best methylene blue. So look out when you get them. But they're selling out, more coming in a month or so. We have plenty of the tincture and the capsules, but not the gummies. If you want them, there's probably 3 or 4 days left of them. Get them now at thealexjonesstore.com. Separately, I can do hours on this. Just go to Wikipedia even. Go to the UN website. Even our enemies admit it. There's an average 15 IQ point reduction in the West because of lack of iodine in the soil and in our foods. Iodine is so good for women, children, adults, pregnant women, but especially older people. But most iodine is a bound iodine to another element. Atomic means on the periodic table, it is pure. We're the only people that put out the pure iodine. And we have it, T3 Trifecta Iodine, at thealexjonesstore.com. Get yours now. I got my iced tea right here. I take it about every 2 days. I'm going to take a dropper full of this bad boy. And this is so good for your brain, your clarity, your cells. It's essential. If you don't get iodine, you die. Again, you don't have oxygen 4 minutes, you're dead. Don't have water for 4 days, you're dead. Don't have food for a month or so, most person dies. You know, unless you're super fat and you live 2 months or whatever. The point is, that's because you're not getting all the essential nutrients and vitamins. Iodine is one of the essential things. Look it up. And the number one cause of cognitive disability, officially, even the World Health Organization, is iodine deficiency. So get yours now at thealexjonesstore.com and be the reason this network continues on and can expand. You're funding folks that fight for your future and our own futures together, trying to stop a new war, trying to stop new pandemics, trying to stop the left, trying to take back civilization. It takes funds to do that. So we sell great products, so it's a 360 win. The only way we fail is you don't take action. Take action now, thealexjonesstore.com.
Today we celebrate the first glorious anniversary of the Information Purification Directives.
Order is the only path to stability.
Compliance is the only path forward.
Alex Jones is a fringe voice and a crackpot.
Our unification of thought is more powerful a weapon than any fleet or army on Earth.
We have created, for the first time in all history, a garden of pure ideology. War is peace.
On May 1st, 2026, Alex Jones will launch his new network, and you will see that the answer to 1984 is still and will always be 1776.
Days, weeks, and even years ahead of the news cycle, AlexJonesLive.com is tomorrow's news today.
If you are receiving this transmission, you are the resistance. Live from Austin, Texas, you're listening to The Alex Jones Show.
I think we found that clip where our president is talking to his daughter-in-law, I guess it is, kind of like the old keep it in the family nepotism ring there. You know, you've got, it's not enough that you have Hannity and these other sycophants on Fox. You have your own family. And in the other room, there's Barron, you know, worth $130 million at age 20. Helps to have some little insider tips on, you know, what's going to go on with the next announcement. Imagine 20 years old worth, he's earned $120 million. That's pretty interesting. Anyway, here's President Trump with Lara talking about America's wealth in gas and oil.
With Iran, so what does a good deal look like for you?
Well, first of all, there's no deal that's good enough because the media will cover it. We're making a great deal. We're going to make a great deal. Or we'll just go back and finish it off militarily. But this would go faster. It's probably better on a humane standpoint. There's something nice about it also. You know, save a lot of lives. And whether it's the other side or not, you save a lot of lives. But we're close to a very good deal. And if we can make it good, otherwise we just start up with the Department of War, as we call it. And it's been very successful. You saw Venezuela. It was a one-day win, and this is really a win already. We've defeated their military, essentially defeated their military. I would rather get a deal because we can open the strait immediately upon signing. The one guarantee that I have to have is that there will be no nuclear weapons. They've agreed to that.
That's not exactly the clip, but it's close. You know, we're going to finish them off militarily. Okay. We've already defeated them militarily. I think he's announced that a dozen times since our sneak attack. If we could have finished them off militarily, we would have done it. And why haven't we done it? Well, I'm old enough to go back and remember actually, I was a kid, but we were paying attention in those days. I was in a very political family. During the Vietnam War, we were able to fly over Vietnam with B-52s, just dropping iron bombs, just raining iron bombs down. The term carpet bombing, which is, used generically today, it literally meant carpet bombing, where each crater of all these bombs was touching the crater behind it, and the B-52s next to you, their craters were touching. So you were literally just annihilating miles and miles of Vietnam, primarily the jungle just to the west of Vietnam, of South Vietnam, in Laos and Cambodia. This was the Ho Chi Minh Trail. This was where China was supplying the army of North Vietnam and the Viet Cong with weapons, and our goal was to cut them off, and we could rain bombs from B-52s. We're talking three times more bombs dropped on Vietnam than were dropped on Germany in the Second World War, three times, with the goal of cutting off resupply from China. South Vietnam is only one-tenth the size of Iran, one-tenth. And we can't fly B-52s over the top of Iran. We can't do it. They would be shot down. We're still in the situation, except for a few the B-2 attacks last year to supposedly take out their nuclear site. We don't fly our manned aircraft right over Iran when we've tried, as we saw with the mysterious pilot rescue. Our planes like F-15s and F-35s risk being shot down. They're shooting down tons of our unmanned Predator and Reaper drones and other even bigger drones. These are like, $10, $20 million drones. These aren't like little Shahed suicide drones. These are aircraft-sized drones. So we have to stay outside of the airspace of Iran and launch by ones and twos these multi-million dollar joint standoff missiles, the JASMs, to fly in and hit a particular target way in the middle of Iran. Remember, this is a country 10 times bigger than South Vietnam, and it's more mountainous than six Colorados. This is why we can't take out their missile cities, because they're under thousands of feet of granite. They bore tunnels straight through mountains. You can hit the tunnel entrances and they'll just clear them. It's like a gopher town, a groundhog town. They don't have one entrance to their complex. They've got a dozen entrances from in all directions under thousands of feet of granite. So we couldn't defeat South Vietnam. And I know people will say, Matt, we were betrayed at home. Jane Fonda made us lose the war. Some Democrat senators, we would have won that war. Come on. We would have won Afghanistan. We would have won Iraq. Yeah, all of them. Doesn't work that way. You have to deal with the political realities. You can't just wish that everybody was as gung-ho as you were. That's not reality. So Iran is 10 times bigger than South Vietnam. We had 500,000 troops in South Vietnam at a time, at the height. We had something like 5,000 aircraft on air bases parked all over South Vietnam. So they could just take off and hit a target 3 minutes away. And we lost the war. The Vietnamese did not surrender. We left. That's the definition of losing. Our goal is to keep the communists out of Saigon. Well, we failed. The communists rolled into Saigon. Iran is 10 times bigger. It has 6 times the population. It has 18,000-foot-high mountains. It's as big as 6 Colorados. It has very smart engineers. Very smart. World class. They don't need to bring in outside talent like the Gulf states or Saudi Arabia. They have their own engineers. And we think that we're going to fire a couple more hundred of our last million-dollar missiles into Iran and cause them to surrender. They fought a war in the 1980s that lasted for 8 years. We were on the side of Saddam Hussein then in Iraq. We gave Saddam Hussein the chemicals to make sarin gas that they put in shells and fired at Iranians. They had Scud missiles that they were firing right into Tehran for months. And in 8 years, they lost between 500,000 and 800,000 people. They didn't surrender. And in fact, those people that were in their teens and 20s in the 1980s, they are the leaders of Iran today. They are not going to surrender. Their whole ethos, their whole coming of age experience was, we were attacked by Iraq and America, and we didn't surrender. They're not going to surrender now. Iran is water self-sufficient. It's almost food self-sufficient. So if you're 90% food self-sufficient, well, then you put a few more notches in your belt and you're food self-sufficient. They make their own missiles. They're going to be resupplied and are being resupplied from Russia and China via the Caspian to the north of Iran. Just like South Vietnam, the Vietnamese were resupplied from China. Iran is being resupplied. And they're being resupplied with the very high-tech stuff, which is not huge in size. Like, for example, infrared cameras to put on their drones. That's a small item. That's something that you can fit in a tiny box. How many of those will fit on a cargo plane being flown in from Russia? Tens of thousands, which means a couple of cargo planes and all of Iran's drones jump an order of magnitude in their effectiveness. This is why the U.S. Navy had to leave the Persian Gulf just before February 28th. We had bases in Kuwait, the major base in Bahrain, in the UAE and in other of the GCC countries. Our Navy had to leave because our admirals understood if our ships were in the Persian Gulf, they'd be sunk. Yesterday, Marco Rubio, he's whining again. The UN has to open the Strait of Hormuz. The Europeans have to come help us. If the U.S. Navy can't open the Strait of Hormuz, it's not going to be opened. It's a matter of geography. You put that map up a little bit ago. It shows the topography of Iran. Iran owns the Strait of Hormuz not because of a treaty, not because of the UN law of the sea or any other treaty. 3 miles, 12 miles, they own it because of geography. Within hundreds of miles of the Strait of Hormuz are thousands of missiles. Our Navy, only during the ceasefire, when Vance was in Pakistan, with Witkoff and Kushner, I think our Navy felt it safe. They won't try anything. We sent a couple of destroyers zipping in past the Strait of Hormuz and then zipping right back out. Our Navy, our best weapons, our aircraft carriers, they have to stay hundreds of kilometers away from Iran. This is a revolution in military affairs. This is the end of the U.S. Navy or any other Navy just rolling up to a country's shores and saying, do what we want or else. Sure, that'll work with Venezuela. U.S. Navy versus Venezuela. That's like, an NFL team versus a little league team, a Pop Warner kind of a team. But when we're up even against like a good college team now, we can't do it because there's been a revolution in weapons. So America has specialized since we've been in the business not of peer-to-peer battles like Ukraine versus Russia. It's pretty close to a peer-to-peer thing at the battlefield level. We've been practicing destroying countries like Libya, Venezuela, okay? Nothing like a peer. So our main problem is we don't want pilots shot down. We don't want to see ships destroyed. So our weapons have to work from, you know, hundreds and thousands of miles away. And they're going to cost millions each. And we'll only be able to afford, you know, in the thousands of them. And that's enough to, like, keep all these little tiny third world countries in line. You know, the Libyas and the Venezuelas, plenty for smacking them down. But we came up against a country that can fight back, and we can't get in range. And we can't afford, you know, the number of weapons. I think more than a third of our Tomahawks that we've taken 20 years to build, more than 20 years, have been depleted in 100 days, mostly in the first 40 days of this war. What does that tell China about us defending Taiwan? If our Navy has to stay 1,000 kilometers from Iran to be safe and constantly moving and on guard, watching, you know, for missile threats, what does that say for us coming to the defense of Taiwan, which is like 100 kilometers from China? I mean, compared to Iran, China is an order of magnitude more powerful. Korea and Japan are in easy range. We have an aircraft carrier in Yokosuka, Japan, tied to a pier that could be destroyed in 5 minutes with a missile from China. We're not learning the lessons of this Iran war, which is we have to rethink how we project power around the world. You know, maybe our Navy would be suitable for a hypothetical blue water encounter, you know, in the middle of the Pacific versus a Chinese fleet, or in the middle of the Atlantic versus the Russian fleet. That's not going to happen. That's like, you know, that's like Hannibal dreaming about a battle between our elephants and your elephants. That war is not going to happen. The war that's happening is cheap, you know, easily produced, accurate weapons that are now built in a new combination. It's a new paradigm. Mass, meaning numbers. We got 10,000 of these things. And accuracy. So it's not like artillery in the old days where we might fire 10,000 artillery shells, but they're just scattered randomly on the battlefield. If your troops are hiding out and also scattered in bunkers and trenches, most of them will do fine. That's not how it's happening anymore. Now these inexpensive drones have a 3-meter accuracy. They'll fly through the exact window that they're aimed at. And it's not a secret that only America has. I mean, when I was young in the military, we thought it was great that we had night vision goggles and the enemy didn't. That we used to say, America owns the night. Well, everybody's got night vision now. Everybody. Maybe not in the middle of the Congo, but everybody else has night vision. And they've got drones with night vision. Fiber optic drones. Like we've seen with Hezbollah in Lebanon, giving the Israelis a lot of trouble. It's like they just thought they can use the old playbook and roll into Lebanon, and their tanks are being wiped out. Any groups of soldiers are being hit. You know, this is why moving to Russia versus Ukraine, there's a lot of talk that, you know, Putin is going to take off the gloves off the, after this dormitory was hit where young teacher students were killed, and he's going to hit Kiev, go after the decision-making centers, meaning like parliament and places where the leaders are living. But that still doesn't get them into Kiev or say Odessa on the Black Sea, you know, that was a Russian port founded by Catherine the Great. Nobody can just roll forward like it's Desert Storm, you know, 1990 era. Nobody can do that anymore. That era has closed. And the time where America could bring, you know, 100,000 troops and park them within helicopter range of an enemy, that is over. I still see people on Fox like former General Kellogg and Keane and Jim Hansen, former spook Jim Hansen, they're saying, why don't we take Karg Island? It's like, are you kidding? If you looked at a map, Karg Island is like 500 miles past the Strait of Hormuz. Our ships can't get there. The Marines on the ships aren't. If our destroyers can't get through there, you think we're going to send, you know, the Boxer and Tripoli in there? Hell no. So that means they're flying by helicopter. They're going to have to, what, take like three helicopter hops to get to Karg Island? Or maybe it'll be parachuting from C-130s. Karg Island is like, you know, 10 miles off the coast of Iran. If we managed to put people on Karg Island, they'd be slaughtered. And that's the level of delusion of our experts that are still getting airtime on TV. You know, this Admiral Bob Harwood, that remember last week he had the thing with the mask. How's my shadow doing? Remember he had the mask on? Where it looked like he had a mask. It was the big discussion. A week before we launched this attack, he said if we attack Iran, we'll win in a matter of hours. That's the he's like our former CENTCOM deputy commander. He's as highly ranked in terms of his knowledge about CENTCOM and Iran and the balance of forces as anybody. And he said a week before February 28th, if we attack, it'll be over in a matter of hours. That's how much faith he had in our you know, gold-plated, super-gazillion-dollar weaponry. We would defeat Iran in a matter of hours. And look what's happened. We can't even put our navy into the Persian Gulf. Iran still controls the Strait of Hormuz. And they always will for as long as they want to. And I still see people on X and on in the news, they say, finish it. I think, I don't know if it was Mark Levin, he said, we did three quarters of the job. Like only 25% more and Iran will collapse. I'm telling you, this is total delusion. Iran is 10 times bigger than South Vietnam, 6 times the population. Bigger mountains than Colorado, bigger mountains than 6 Colorados. They make their own food. They have their own water. They make their own weapons. What they don't make is being flown in on the big cargo planes from Russia. Chinese and Russian tech is being flown in. They're not going to surrender. The world's economy is going to completely crash if we don't get this sorted out ASAP. We're only talking now about how deep will this depression be. Will it be, you know, worse than the 1930s, or will it be something like a recession, 2008 or 1973? But we are going to hit tank bottom, and it's not going to be a question of how much does gas cost. It's going to be you can't get diesel, and the trucks can't bring the food to the store. And next year, the harvest was only half. So now we're competing for what food there is. But the talking heads on TV are still behind the effort saying a deal is imminent and then the price of gas is going to drop lower than ever. This is like Trump saying, you know, we make twice as much fuel as Russia and Saudi Arabia. This is like Admiral Harwood saying we can defeat Iran in a matter of hours. He's still on TV. They still say, here's our expert, former deputy CENTCOM commander. They don't say, a week before we launched this, he said it would be over in a matter of hours. I mean, how do you ever get on TV after that without that being your byline? You know, fool, said it would be over in a matter of hours. That's the level of people on our side. But I think that smarter people in the Navy have gotten to Trump. Because when we tried this Project Freedom a couple weeks ago, where we were going to escort or, as they said, guide ships through the southern route, the Oman, near Oman at the southern end of the Strait of Hormuz, that lasted what? One night? Two ships snuck out. Another ship, a French ship, was hit. Our destroyers had to flee under fire. And we used to run the Persian Gulf. We used to have aircraft carriers in the Persian Gulf. This war has been a total fiasco, and it's showing the whole world what the limits are on American power projection. And the rest of the world is not happy coming to America to buy our fuels at, you know, the mafia extortionist price. Like, we blew up the other gas station in town. Now you got to buy your gas from us. You're going to only do that until you can figure out how to go somewhere else. We are driving the world away from us. And now we're talking about slipping into an omnibus bill, the fusion of the American and the Israeli military, that it won't be a foreign aid package of military. We're just going to meld the Israeli army, the Gaza genocide army, the white phosphorus blasting on civilians army. We're going to fuse with them. So you can't even tell inside of our budget what is Israeli and what is American. We are driving the world against us. And if you just watch mainstream news, much less Fox, even CNN, where they're hedging, it's like, well, what if it does work out? We don't want to just say it's a complete idiocy what's happening, but it is a complete idiocy what's happening. And we are going to be paying the price for a long time for this, because people are not going to forget. People, number one, will never trust us in negotiations. We use the cover of diplomacy. See you Monday in Geneva. Bombs on Saturday. You just don't do that. Not if you want to continue having any kind of trust from people. Anyway, I'm glad to have been here today. I did kind of a quick get ready process, so I hope it was all right. And I do still have these books for sale. You can get them on Amazon, but if you buy them from me, I can sign them. And it's better for me, a lot better for me. Amazon right now, I practically give them money to ship books to Amazon. It's pathetic. But we're going to also have a new book out in a little while about Ireland, another future kind of future fiction novel. And the next show after this is going to be Sunday Night Live with Royce White. So stay tuned for that. And I never know when I'll see you again, but whenever I do, I'm sure there'll be some news, because we're living in such interesting times. Every day I wake up and I turn on the TV to see what's blown up around the world or not. And I hope that it's not. Anyway, I'll see you again. And yep, make sure to visit the Alex Jones store, because that's the only way that we stay on the air. I'll talk to you again. And my website, enemiesforeignanddomestic.com.
Folks, I'm Dr. Bigley. Today's presentation will be about methylene blue and you.
Dr. Bigley, what does methylene blue do?
Great question, Billy. It has to do with your mitochondria, the powerhouse of your cells. Let's bring out the mitochondria now!
Right.
As I was saying, methylene blue supercharges your mitochondria, which does wonders for your mental clarity, stamina, and overall pep. Just look at him go!
Gee, Dr. Bigley, he must have drank a lot of methylene blue. He was bouncing off the walls.
Right you are, Billy. He sure drank a lot. Let's continue, shall we?
Billy, did you know that methylene blue can cure communism?
No, sir. Can I see?
Why, certainly, Billy. Take a look over there.
Behold, Ivan, a Ruski doggedly determined to undermine our way of life. Careful, Billy. He bites. Oh. Look, vodka. Potato hooch. Watch. The communism is slowly leaving his body.
Wow! The methylene blue cured the red right out of him.
So, how do you feel?
Gee, Doc, I don't know what got into me. I feel like $1 million now. Say, where can I get some more of that blue stuff in case I become retarded again?
You can find it on the alexjonesstore.com.
What does .com mean?